I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. As the new year begins, many of us are resolving to shed a few pounds. Today on this edition of Smart Nutrition, the nutrition diva Monica Reinagel and a behavioral economist Dan Ariely on weight loss strategies, behaving irrationally, and smart scales that use colors instead of numbers to monitor progress. Plus, a powerful new tool for genetically altering food could change the way we think about GMOs. CRISPR technology could make food more plentiful and even more nutritious. So why are many food companies taking GMOs out of their products? We'll take your calls, emails, and tweets with questions for the Nutrition Diva, Monica Reinagel, and Smart Nutrition, up next when Midday gets underway right after these headlines. He's Dr. James Brown. He has a PhD in funk. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. We are very glad about that fact. Today, it's another edition of Smart Nutrition. We're going to spend the hour talking about eating right, staying fit. As always, we are joined by Monica Reinagel, the nutrition diva. She's a board-certified licensed nutritionist who blogs at nutritionovereasy.com. Happy New Year, Monica. Good to see you.
Hi, Tom. Great to be back with you.
And joining us on the phone from Palo Alto, California is Dan Ariely. He's a behavioral economist. He's an author and a filmmaker, and he's on the faculty at Duke University, where he runs the Center for Advanced Hindsight. Dan Ariely, welcome to Midday.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
And I have to tell you, best name for a lab ever.
Thank you.
Ever.
It's a little hard to raise money with this name, but it's really good.
I mean, I don't know anything about that, but I just, the Center for Advanced Hindsight. So tell me what happens on a typical day at the Center for Advanced Hindsight.
Very good. So so we are a group that does applied behavioral economics. And behavioral economics is an area that look at all the ways in which we are irrational and try to think about how we make behavior slightly better. And we focus on financial decision-making and health, and we're trying to figure out how to get people to spend less, save more, spend in wiser ways, and then on the health side, how to get people to exercise, take their medication, eat a bit better. And we're thinking about technological solutions a lot because technology is all around us. And one of the big findings in social science in the last 50 years is that the environment matters, that many of our decisions are driven not by who we are, but what our environment makes easy or hard, compatible or incompatible with our ability to think. And therefore, if we change the environment, we can get people to behave in better ways.
So, Monica Reinagel, I mean, changing an environment can seems to be a pretty difficult thing to do. I mean, on its face. I mean, we are what we are. We live where we live. We have kitchens that are located where they're located. We have, you know, proclivities that we have sort of grown up with, that seems to be hard.
Sure, but we do have control over what we bring into our kitchens and where we store it and, you know, which items and foods we leave out at ready, at arm's length and at eye level, and which ones we might tuck away further in the back of the cabinet or the refrigerator. You'd be surprised at how much control we have over our environment and what a big difference it can make. And I've been following Dan's work on this for couple of decades now, and I've seen the difference that this can make.
Yeah. So, Dan, is it a matter of small tweaks like that, or is it a matter of major overhauls of environmental influences?
Well, you want both. It's not look, things like dieting is a daily struggle, right? You have to do it all the time. In some sense, something like quitting smoking is easier than dieting. Because with smoking, you know if you're a smoker or not a smoker. You have a rule. With dieting, you don't have the same rule. And dieting is kind of it's a fight for every cookie and every bite and every forkful. So we need both. We need some changes that are more dramatic, but there's a lot of gain to be made by making small tweaks as well.
And in terms of our proclivity for irrationality, I mean, I myself consider myself an expert in acting irrationally, and I bet a whole lot of our listeners feel that they are equally expert. I mean, what are some of the ways that we act irrationally, and is it simply a matter of saying, oops, that's irrational, I'm not going to do that anymore?
No. So
I didn't think so.
So examples are how our emotions misdirect us, right? So think about lots of the ailments in society, overeating, undersaving, texting and driving. Texting and driving, think of it as an example. Most people admit that they text and drive from time to time. And they admit that they know how stupid and dangerous it is, right? We can kill ourselves. We can kill other people. It's a tremendous... I mean, the penalty is not the few hundred dollars of a ticket you might get. The penalty is dying. But nevertheless, most of us do it from time to time, recognizing how wrong it is. And the challenge there is that we're not good in thinking about now versus later, right? When something is a probabilistic, delayed... a penalty, even if it's very large, like dying, we don't give it enough attention. So our emotions, which are designed by evolution as a survivor mechanism, right? If you're at the edge of the jungle 20,000 years ago and you see a tiger, you want to just start running, not to think, not to consider it. And emotions were designed to get us to just act. But now they're not always work in our best interest, and we have these things like phones that we get addicted to, and we have particular types of foods where you say to yourself, I'll just have one potato chip. But, you know, the people who designed the potato chip also have they have a plan, too, and their plan is not for you to have just one. And they basically do the combination of salt and sugar and... that would get you to tempt.
And advertising that's used to say, bet you can't eat just one. I mean, they go directly to that, yeah.
That's right. And it's not just advertising. They're right. They're designing the chips to make them this way. So what happened is we don't have that much ability to think long term. We don't have that much willpower. And as a consequence, we fail. We fail a lot. And actually, you can there was a very sad analysis that looked at the question of, what is the percentage of people who die because they made a mistake, and not just accelerate their death, right? So if you're drunk and you drive, that's an example. If you smoke, and they showed that about 100 years ago it was about 10%, and now it's more than 40%. And what has happened is not that we got more stupid.
Wait, 40% of people die because they made a mistake?
They accelerate their death because of mistakes. Yeah.
Wow.
And this includes obesity and diabetes and smoking and texting and driving and all of those things. And it's not as if, you know, every smoker dies because of smoking, but the death is certainly accelerated because of that. And the thing is that we have really been specializing in the last 100 years in the temptation industry, right? And some of those things are clear, like casinos, that are temptation industry. But the reality is that much of the food industry is part of the temptation industry. Much of the apps industry, Facebook, is about temptation. Many of those entities are trying to reach us not by giving us a logical reason of why we should spend time, money, and attention on those things, but they try to tap our emotions, and they're doing it quite successful.
And Monica, in the work that you do, you have groups of people that you give coaching to and tips to about how to, you know, lose weight and eat healthy and stuff. Is it a matter of just avoiding the temptations, or I guess to avoid it, you have to first of all understand that it is a temptation. I mean, data matters. So if you've got that little data point, you can say, okay, Facebook can be addictive, or, you know, potato chips can be addictive to a certain extent. So do you avoid it, or do you just sort of understand that's what it is, and therefore you can, you know, knowledge is power and you can overcome it?
I think awareness is a big part of the equation here. And I think, as Dan started out by telling us, you know, working on our environment to remove temptation can be part of it. But there are a lot of different ways to build in motivation and, you know, and accountability. I'm a big fan of keeping track, you know, so that we have an objective referendum on how we're doing. So, for example, if you're trying to lose weight, I I know this is controversial, but I think it's a good idea to get on the scale really regularly. But there are some real pitfalls to that, getting on the scale regularly. There's some problems with that. And which is why I was so fascinated to see a very novel solution that Dan has come up with to help make that accountability and that monitoring more successful by avoiding some of those traps and pitfalls.
Yeah, and Dan, you have designed and you started a company, I guess, that's designed to scale. It's commercially available, and it's called the Shapa. Is that right?
Yeah.
And so how does this work? I understand that there's no numbers on this scale, which makes it incredibly attractive to me right off the bat. I mean, I haven't seen it, but I'm in. I don't know. But how does it work?
Yeah, so here are three facts about this scale. Fact one, it's really good to stand on the scale every day, as Monica was saying. And it's good to stand on the scale in the morning, not so much in the evening. And it's not because we weigh more in the evening. It's because if we stand on the scale in the morning, it's like a little ritual that reminds us that we want to be healthy, and then we behave slightly better for the rest of the day. So that's fact one. Fact two, weight fluctuates a lot. All of us have weight fluctuates, maybe 2 or 3 pounds. If you're overweight, it could go up to 8 or 10 pounds a day. And this fluctuation creates two things. The first one is what we call gain aversion. Days when your weight goes up by 2 pounds are really miserable. Days that your weight goes down by 2 pounds are happy, but they don't make up for it. So most people feel bad about their scale. Even if their weight doesn't go up and down, doesn't go up overall, the up and down creates this process of making the average day unhappy.
Well,
and the last thing that happens is that people expect their body to react very quickly. People say, I've been on a diet for a whole day, for 2 days. And then they step on the scale and they expect it to go down, but it doesn't. It can take the body 10 days or 2 weeks. So what happened is that standing on the scale is good, but the information has lots of noise, right? It fluctuates by how much salt and when you went to the bathroom and all kinds of other things. So the readout is not good. So we created a scale with no display. And we said, let's separate the act of standing on the scale from the act of getting feedback. Those are two separate things. And people step on the scale and we say, congratulations, you did your job. You stood on the scale. That's a good thing. And then we do give people feedback, but it's kind of a running average of the last 3 weeks. And it only gives them the information in terms of a trend. You're just the same. Nothing is happening. Slightly better, slightly worse, much better, much worse.
And the time frame is 2 to 3 weeks?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Because that's the amount of data that you need to give people information that is about the real trend and not about the noise. Right? So information, from my perspective, is for good decision-making. And you want to understand the relationship between what you're doing, what actions you're taking, how you're eating, and what you're doing for exercise, and what is happening to it. And it takes a couple of weeks for that information to show up. So imagine somebody who diets for 3 days, step on the scale, and nothing good happened. Their weight went up by 0.5 pound. And then they take a break for a day because they're discouraged, and they watch Netflix the whole day and eat pizza, and then they step on the scale, and then the weight goes down a little bit, right? It's very confusing and demotivating. So the idea is to give people information at the granularity that may help decision making.
So you
separate
separate the feedback from the ritual of standing on the scale.
Exactly.
But isn't that kind of like getting a medal for participation? I mean, if you don't actually achieve some measurable weight loss, I mean,
well, you do actually get feedback with the Shapa after enough data has been collected to get a true picture of what's happening. Correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, but every time you step on the scale, you do get a message saying, okay, you're staying the same. You're gaining weight.
That's right.
You're losing weight. So that feedback eventually does start coming on a daily basis, but it's not attached to a number. And I think that's one of the things that's so helpful here, because a lot of people have a lot of baggage about their weight and they avoid the scale because they don't want to see, you know, they don't want to engage with that number. And then that takes away the possible benefit of that ritual. And so this is a way to get people to focus on not where they are, not how far they have to go, but just, are they headed in the right direction? Which I think is enormously helpful from a behavioral standpoint. And then also make sure that feedback is real, that it's not just based on these sort of meaningless fluctuations that happen from day to day in your weight that don't have anything to do with whether you're actually losing fat. So that's the two things that I think make this a really useful approach.
And so far, the data that you've collected with the folks that are using this device is promising?
The data is amazing. I have to say it beats my expectations. We went to a call center. We wanted to get people who are relatively obese, relatively low income. You know, these are the people that are hardest to change their behavior. And we didn't do what people usually do, which is self-selection. Let's just get the people who are more interested. We got everybody into the plan. And the people who got the regular scale basically gained a little bit of weight every month for 5 months. The study lasted 5 months. And the people who got our scale lost about 0.7% of their body weight every month for 5 months. And 0.7% is a lot. The ideal weight loss is about 1%. And the idea that you can get almost all the way there just by getting people to stand on a scale and see the number in a way that is not frightening and help them understand the relationship between cause and effect is just tremendous.
So 1% of body weight per month is a reasonable expectation for weight loss?
It would be great. If you could get that, it's the most likely to be sustained. You know, mm-hmm. You could do all kinds of crazy things to starve your body and, you know, just have juice or do all kinds of things. But for sustained weight loss, what we should aim for is about 1%.
Well, Dan Ariely, it's been fascinating talking to you and finding out, again, about my favorite lab name ever, the Center for Advanced Hindsight at Duke University. So thank you so much for your time. I know we have to let you go, but I very much appreciate it, and Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year, and looking forward to next time.
Dan Ariely is a behavioral economist at Duke University. He's the founder of the Center for Advanced Hindsight and the co-founder of Shape, a California company that makes this numberless scale we've been talking about, designed to take at least some of the anxiety out of weight loss. He's joined us on the phone from Palo Alto, California. And Monica Reinagle is, of course, the nutrition diva. She blogs about healthy eating on nutritionovereasy.com. She'll be back with us after a short break. Smart Nutrition continues with a look at some of the tools being deployed to genetically alter some of the foods we eat. And along with a list of 10 worst presidents ever, U.S. News and World Report has a list of best diets. Monica is frowning, and we'll find out why when we come back. You are welcome to join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall, our music, James Brown.
You're listening to Midday here on your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
James Brown, ladies and gentlemen, James Brown, pass the peas. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the worldwide broadcast tomorrow, we turn our attention to the major problems encountered at many Baltimore City public schools during last week's extremely cold weather. The General Assembly is beginning their 2018 session at this hour. Tomorrow, we'll talk to school officials. We'll talk a little to Delegate Maggie McIntosh, who represents Baltimore and chairs the House Appropriations Committee. And we'll speak with some leaders of the Baltimore Education Coalition to find out what's up with the Baltimore City schools. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, it's another edition of Smart Nutrition. My guest is the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle. She is a board-certified licensed nutritionist who blogs at nutritionovereasy.com. By the way, you can sign up for Monica's biweekly newsletter for information about all manner of nutrition-related topics. And the topic we're going to turn to now is the controversial issue of genetically altered food. So if you've got opinions about that, do you avoid it? Do you care about it? Do you even know whether or not some of the products you buy contain genetically altered food? Give us a call, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. We also like to hear from folks who perhaps, like many, have established a New Year's resolution to drop a couple pounds and find out how you're doing that. So we'll take all of your questions, your comments, again, 410-662-8780. So the first thing we should talk about, Monica, when it comes to these GMOs, and you wrote a big piece about this in Food and Nutrition magazine, is that it's the data about it and about its safety and about, you know, just the whole area is in some ways discordant with what consumers think about genetically altered food. They don't necessarily sync. So what do we know about GMOs when it comes to food? And if people are afraid of things or at least skeptical about it, is that based on what we know?
This is one of the most emotional debates that I can think of in the area of food and nutrition. It's been going on for a long time. And yes, consumers are extremely concerned about genetically modified foods, or GMOs, as they're usually referred to, and state that avoiding them is a really high priority. And yet, there is a widespread consensus in the scientific community that these foods are safe to eat, that the, you know, concerns that accompany, whenever you introduce a new technology, there's always concerns about, well, we don't know what we don't know. And that's perfectly valid. But these foods have been part of the food supply for 25 years now. And we've had a chance to, well, not we, I haven't done this research, but the researchers have had a chance to run down these concerns and take, you know, a close look at them. And they've really, over time, put to rest, you know, most if not all of the concerns about the safety of these foods, and yet consumers remain unconvinced. And who wields the most power? Consumers. And so, you know, manufacturers have started removing GMO ingredients from their foods because it is such a strong selling point, because there is so much concern in the consumer marketplace. And so we're starting to see more and more foods advertised as being GMO free, and brands promoting the fact that they are actively removing GMO ingredients from their foods. So in a way, the debate has been resolved by commercial forces, you know. Ironically, though, the science has moved on. And we now have much more precise and flexible and efficient ways of achieving some of the goals that we were trying to achieve with GMO foods. And so while the manufacturers and the consumers continue to focus on GMOs, the genetics has moved past this into, you know, a brave new world of technology.
And the brave new world, to a certain extent, can make it safer, right? It can make it less susceptible to the kinds of dangers that people were worried about 25 years ago. I mean, there is some evidence that says that food, first of all, can be drought resistant, can be pest resistant, can even have greater nutritional value if it's modified in certain ways to get rid of bad stuff. And it's the way that we're modifying it now, which I guess makes it a little easier to mass produce. Is that right?
Let me clarify that. The goals that you just outlined, increasing crop yields to address a growing world population, increasing drought resistant. We're seeing more and more frequent and more severe droughts. And so increasing resistance to that, increasing resistance to pests and diseases to allow us to use fewer chemicals. Those are all the same goals that we were trying to address and addressing with genetically modified organisms. The goals aren't new. The methods are new. And what these newer technologies offer us is, instead of having to kind of cut and paste chunks of DNA from one organism to another in order to try to transfer desirable traits, what they can do now is go into a living organism, a corn plant or anything else, a banana, a tomato, and they can actually very precisely edit the organism's own DNA sequence in order to introduce desirable traits or suppress undesirable traits. And so it's a much more refined approach. It's much more precise. And one of the things I think that might make it safer is that there are far fewer unintended consequences, and you can see much more quickly what the outcomes are. So it's really speeding research and development and allowing scientists to make progress on all of those same fronts, increasing crop yield, increasing drought resistance, reducing the use of chemicals much more quickly, and much less it's less costly to develop these new crops. This technology is also much more efficient, and that will, you know, bring these these products to market more quickly.
It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Monica Reinagle is the nutrition diva, and she's with me here today in Studio A. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, and to find us on Twitter at Midday Tom Hall. So it's this CRISPR technology that is the sort of new kid on the block, although mm-hmm. it's not brand new. It's been around for a while. So this is CRISPR. Lord knows what that acronym means. But we have talked about this in relation to human genome editing with our good friend Jeff Kahn from the Berman Institute for Bioethics at Johns Hopkins and all of the consequences, both intended and unintended, that have developed as that technology is applied to human beings and disease. But what you're saying, I guess, is that the older technology prior to CRISPR had us taking things from one organism and implanting it in another, whereas this CRISPR thing doesn't have any transfer from something outside the original organism. It's all done within that one piece of corn or that one tomato. It's not bringing anything in from afar. It's bringing it. It's just altering the sequence inside.
That's exactly right. I like to explain it like this. If genetic modification was kind of like using Photoshop to take the head off one body and paste it on somebody else's body, CRISPR technology is more like getting in there with Photoshop and just editing a couple of pixels to erase the crow's feet around the eyes or to erase a flyaway hair. Much more refined ability. Of course, it is somewhat limited by our understanding of the genome. You know, in order to edit this sequence, we need to know exactly which parts of the genome are responsible for what. So that is, you know, one limiting factor. You can't edit something if you can't read it. And so it depends on our, it's been dependent on the very rapid sequencing of genomes across many species.
Let's go to the phones. Steve in Cockeysville, welcome to Midday with Monica Reinagle.
Hi there, Tom. I'm going to preface this by saying I'm of an age that I've seen plenty of times when science got it wrong. But having said that, with continued unchecked population growth and diminished arable land, I don't see any alternative to GMO products. I'm not crazy about the idea, but you can't keep destroying the Amazon and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So how else are you going to feed the population? And that's my concern, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, thanks for the call, Steve.
I think Steve makes an excellent point here. With any technology or technological advance, you always have to weigh costs and benefits, you know, risks and benefits. And we do have some really big problems to solve here. We do have a growing population. As Steve points out, we have a limited amount of land to grow food on. And so we need to kind of weigh what our concerns are and what rational concerns might be against what we stand to gain. But I will just add to Steve's comment that, you know, there is now an alternative to GMOs, and that is this newer generation of genome-edited foods, and which may allow us to accomplish many of those same goals using newer, more precise technology.
Karen sends an email and says, all of our domestic animals and food plants have been genetically modified through selective breeding. It just took longer. And you make this case as well in your article in Food and Nutrition magazine that, you know, genetic modification of organisms happens in nature without any interference from us.
That's right. I'm so glad you made that point, Karen. Not only have we been genetically modifying organisms through selective breeding for millennia, but organisms modify themselves without any intervention whatsoever on our part, just through random mutation. So, you know, excellent point.
John in Crownsville, welcome to Midday with the Nutrition Diva.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Always tough because, you know, you call in with one point and then you hear other callers and now you have other points. So I'll try to spare you of those. But I was just going to say this notion of precision gene editing somehow diminishing the risks that are associated with GMOs seems to be a little bit misplaced. I mean, by metaphor, I could either cut my entire arm off or I could go in and cut out all of my veins. I still don't have a functioning arm. And it seems to me that gene editing is different in kind from adding features to the plants. I think there's a case, and it's probably dated at this point, about the golden rice modifications that were helping solve some of the famine problems in Asia. which is different from sort of the Monsanto kind of seed-killing genetic modifications that I know have plagued Canada and the United States. So it's a complicated issue when we talk about genetic modification. Maybe there's some good ones, maybe there's some bad ones. But I just want to say I don't think that this notion that it's more acceptable because we're being more precise about modifying things obviates the debate that needs to be placed about whether or not the modifications would have ever come about by natural selection or by selective breeding, as you had pointed out. And there's a point at which it's either the plant or it's the plant being modified by other plants versus human beings. So.
Well, thank you, John. Those are really good points. And, you know, Monica, this is a nuanced thing. It's complicated. It ain't cut and dry.
For sure. And I think that is always necessary to differentiate between a technology and its potential and all of its possible applications. And so, you know, we can debate what good uses for this technology might be or what harmful uses it might be put to, for sure.
And as a matter of public policy, and we certainly talk about this a lot with Jeff Kahn at the Berman Institute for Bioethics, coming up with global recommendations or global criteria or global rules about this is very difficult to do, just in a political sense. But, you know, there are people trying to develop public policy criteria for use of this technology.
Yeah, and of course, with any regulatory process, it's difficult when the field is evolving so fast that because the legislative and regulatory process is not swift, and often by the time they've kind of hammered out something that makes sense, the science has moved on to the point. For case in point, the current regulations that are in place around the approval, testing, and approval for safety of genetically modified organisms don't apply to this new CRISPR technology because it doesn't meet the definition that they wrote those regulations around.
And they wrote those like in the 80s or something, or the 90s or something.
Well, they've been evolving ever since. But yeah, another challenge with regulation, other than trying to get a global community, and we are a global community, to agree on the principles, is that things are evolving so quickly. The pace of change, as we've all noticed, has sped up. And so, but the pace of regulation has not.
Yeah, indeed. Marty in Middletown, welcome to Midday with Monica Reinagel.
Yeah, hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
You raised so many good points, and I wanted to touch on the issues of, you already mentioned, unintended consequences. And I think one of my point is that variety is the reservoir of resilience in biology. So when you're taking something and you're modifying it to suit current conditions and you're eliminating the variety of a crop, you know, I can eat, I can have tomato sauce today. It's just perfect for me and it doesn't hurt me a bit. But, you know, if those crops have been sprayed with something like Roundup or whatever, you may not be hurting the ketchup, all right, but the pollinators, the butterflies and the hummingbirds, what about them? What about that?
Good point, Marty. I mean, because it's not just the thing that's being altered itself, but the stuff around the thing, if I may use
very
really
precise,
complicated scientific terms there.
Right. But these consequences apply to every form of agriculture, any form of pest control or weed control. And they are things that we want to think about, maintaining biological diversity and the effects, the wider effects in the environment beyond the target that we're applying it to. But we need to take those into consideration for every form of crop and agriculture and control that's put into that. That's not unique, I think, to genetically engineered foods. It really is something that applies to all forms of agriculture.
I mean, given the fact that genetic engineering when it comes to food has been around for decades now, it's not a thing that happened 6 months ago. And one would assume then that there is a certain degree of pervasiveness of this kind of food in the marketplace. I mean, you go to the farmer's market and you buy a bushel of corn from somebody, you can maybe say that that farmer's not genetically modifying the thing, but if you have corn products in other stuff that you buy, mm-hmm. can you be sure? Can you easily avoid GMOs if, in fact, for whatever reason, you want to avoid GMOs, or is it just impossible to avoid?
No, it's not impossible. And this is the whole rationale behind the GMO labeling movement. They failed to convince the government that foods should be labeled if they do contain genetically modified organisms because the government scientists concluded that there was no meaningful difference between them. And so they shouldn't have to be labeled. But they can't be prevented from labeling foods that do not have genetically modified organisms. And so there are certifying agencies. And you'll see when you go to the grocery store, tons of foods that have on the front of the package non-GMO, GMO-free, because consumers do express a preference for that. Some consumers do make that a priority. So no, it's not at all impossible. And I think that the demand for those foods will, in some way, ensure that they remain available.
But what if you're not buying food that's in a package?
Sure. If you're at a restaurant, yeah.
Yeah.
Then you're really, unless you are patronizing a restaurant that has staked a claim for only sourcing non-GMO ingredients, then yes, you would.
Monica Reinagle is the nutrition diva. She blogs at nutritionovereasy.com. She'll be back with me after a quick break. We will continue this edition of Smart Nutrition here on Midday. We'll take your calls, your questions, your comments, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. If you have one of those computer things like our director and engineer, Luke, he's got two of them. He's got one at home and one here in the office. You can find us on Twitter at Midday Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday here on your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
Once more, ladies and gentlemen, pass the peas. James Brown, I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. If you've just joined us, it's Smart Nutrition with the nutrition diva Monica Reinagle. We're taking your calls, your emails, and your tweets. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Let's go to the phones again. Tristan in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Hey, thanks for having me on the program. Excuse me. I just wanted to point out that this idea that GMOs are needed to feed the world, this is largely a myth. And it's largely a myth for two reasons. The first is that the vast majority of GMOs are designed not to, grow better, but to withstand chemical pesticides and herbicides. So the primary goal is to, and these seeds are produced by the chemical companies, so they are designed for the chemical companies to sell more of these products and to expand this model of agriculture that uses these kinds of chemicals. Second, I think there has not been a lot of research pointing out that GMOs, excuse me, or this chemical model of agriculture is necessarily more productive. If a agriculture without chemicals but that embraces ecological principles is used, research has shown that it can be just as productive as sort of the conventional chemical-based agriculture. It's just a different kind of productivity. You can't grow 1,000 acres of corn organically, but you can grow many different kinds of crops, and you get, on average, a greater productivity per acre, but of a variety of different crops. So it's a different kind of productivity. And hunger, that's the kind of productivity we need. We need small farms growing lots of fruits and vegetables and diverse crops. That's how you end hunger. It's not through large industrial farms producing commodities like corn and soybeans. And these are the kinds of crops that are genetically modified.
All right. Thanks for your call, Tristan. Of course, there are lots of folks who would say we need both. We need the small farms and large mega farms or whatever, corporate farms. In your article, Monica, you write that there currently are 9 transgenically modified food crops that are commercially available. So we've got corn, soybean, squash, papaya, alfalfa, sugar beets, canola, potato, and apples. You write that back in 1988, They figured out a genetically modified tomato for human consumption. They brought it to market 6 years later, and it didn't produce enough profit. So they stopped. So right now you can't find a genetically modified tomato, right? But you can get corn, soybean, squash, papaya, alfalfa, sugar beets, canola, potato, and apple.
So to Tristan's point, it is true that a lot of those first-generation genetically modified organisms in that list that you just read off, the modification was to allow them to withstand a specific chemical. And these seeds were developed by the company selling the chemical. I mean, it was a pretty clever little system there. But I'd like to differentiate between the foods that were developed using the first generation of GMO technology and the kinds of things that they're working on now with CRISPR technology. Because I think because it is so much more efficient, it lowers the cost of research and development, and it opens up the possibility for developing foods from people other than giant chemical companies, you know, and it makes it perhaps easier to address some of these other things. The only other, and he makes a lot of great points and ones that I'm very, that resonate with me as well. We probably don't have time to go through them one by one. The only other thing that came up as he was talking is that, yes, organic agriculture, you know, as opposed to conventional agriculture, can produce a different kind of diversity and value from the land without using the same sorts of methods and chemicals. But I do worry about drought. This is something that is spreading worldwide, and you know the absence of chemicals is not going to fix the absence of water. And so if we can use this, not genetic modification, not GMOs, but this CRISPR-9, this genome editing to make plants that are more drought resistant, I think that probably could be a nice insurance policy for a future that looks like it's going to be hotter and drier than we've ever known.
Let's go to Deborah in Frederick. Deborah, welcome to Midday with Monica Reinagle.
Hi, I have two questions or comments. The first is that you say that genetic modification has been going on for millennia. I really, selective breeding has been going on, but that's not the same as genetic modification. And you're talking about the two as if they're interchangeable, and they're really not.
No, I think we're not making that part. Genetic modification has not been around for millennia. It's been around for a couple of decades.
Well, I think there's a semantic distinction. Genetic modification just means the modification of the genetic sequence, and that has been happening since plants started growing. But Deborah's absolutely correct that we have, as a culture, as a society, taken this term genetic modification and collectively decided that we're going to apply it to genetically engineered food. So it's unfortunate that the language can be sort of imprecise and misleading. So yes, genes and genomes get modified all the time, whether we do anything about it. But when we say GMO or genetically modified, what we're really talking about are genetically engineered foods. And I think sometimes these conversations go awry just because of the way that we use and understand the actual words.
And Deborah, forgive us for interrupting.
But you're the one who said that it's been going on for millennia, so thanks for the clarification. Secondly, can you explain if a CRISPR technology is used to make a plant more drought resistant, is that then reflected in the subsequent seeds that plant produces? Is that how it's passed on, or isn't it passed on?
Yeah, the idea is that these would be heritable traits. So once you've modified that organism, when that organism reproduces, it will pass along its modified sequence to its offspring. Otherwise, you'd have to get in there and modify every plant one by one, and that wouldn't be very efficient.
Does that make you less or more skeptical of GMO foods, Deborah?
I'm not skeptical. I just wanted a clarification.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Let's go to Tom in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday with the Nutrition Diva. And Tom is gone, but we will come back to Tom if he calls back. Ellen in Baltimore, welcome to the show. Thanks for your call.
Hi. The problem in my mind is trusting science, basically. You know, if thalidomide had created us, you know, an inheritable characteristic, you know, we'd all be walking around, you know, really with problems. And the idea is, so the talking about applications conceals, you know, sort of instead of consequences. And regulations are never going to be able to look at all the consequences because they could be very long term. And before, you know, anything problematic shows up, like the effect on bees or whatever. and you know, and the idea that we should trust science to do something that's irreversible, that's terrifying, actually.
And Ellen, if you don't trust science, is there something you trust?
Well, it's, you know, look, I mean, there's nature, right? Nature is doing its thing. It's not necessarily, you know, helping or harming us. But, you know, just the idea that the human mind, you know, can get in there and you know, and tamper with Mother Nature, and we're going to trust it that those so-called applications are not going to have horrible, unintended consequences, to me is, well, I mean, we're going to do it anyway because we're stupid. And, you know, I mean, look at the history of humanity. It's horrible. So we're going to do whatever it's possible to do, especially if it makes money. But, you know, nonetheless, you know, I think people need to be aware that, you know, that there are big question marks around this. And just talking about applications, you know, just in terms of what this other fellow just called about in terms of, you know, organics and, you know, and feeding people, that, you know, that's been Monsanto. Look, Europe is already questioning whether Roundup is a carcinogen. The World Health Organization has called it a carcinogen, and you know, and we're spraying it on everything in our backyards. So, you know, so much for nature.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the perspective, Ellen. Appreciate it. It's a difficult thing to parse out, and there is by no means huge consensus about the specifics of this worldwide.
That's right. I think there are question marks around taking action, and there are question marks around not taking action. You know, we never can really understand the consequences of our choices, and it is super tricky to try to weigh the possible benefits or the possible actions, consequences of taking action or not taking action. And, you know, unfortunately, nature left to its own devices might have been able to take care of us, but we've been interfering with nature to its disadvantage for quite some time. So, yeah, certainly we don't want our attempt at solving some of the problems that we've created to create new and worse problems. That's never the intention.
So, Monica, we just got a couple of minutes left, and I do want to go back to dieting, because U.S. News and World Report came out with a list of the top diets. They ranked the diets for 2018. And, you know, this kind of thing gets a lot of play. I mean, it gets, you know, talked about on silly talk shows like this one that I'm talking about it right now. But these are lists that just drive you nuts.
Yeah. I mean, and these lists are, first of all, people should understand what they are if they wait for that report to come out every year to pick their New Year's diet. You know, these are not necessarily rankings based on research showing which diets are most effective. These are just the most popular diets, and then they get a bunch of experts in a room and they show them the diets, and they look at them and they see which ones they think that make the most sense. So, and the process, I will say, is very transparent. If you want to know what their criteria were and who was involved and what their process was, they make that very clear. But the thing that really made me roll my eyes this year was a category, and to be honest, I feel like I haven't seen this category before. I'm not 100% sure it's new this year, but it was, so they rank them in different categories, best for heart health, best for diabetes, right? Best for weight loss. And then the category that I hadn't seen before was best for fast weight loss. And, you know, to me, that term fast weight loss, best fast weight loss, is a complete oxymoron. The faster the weight loss, the worse it is.
For
reasons that Dan was explaining to us earlier in the hour.
Yeah, and for the slackers like me in the audience, if you want to cheat, you can go to the very end, and the last list is the easiest diets to follow list. So it is in there, but of course we're not going to recommend it because we're rational human beings, even though Dan Ariely says that we're completely irrational. Well, it was a great rational decision of mine, one of the few, to have you back on the show. And we look forward to the next time. Monica, thanks.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Monica Reinagle is the nutrition diva. She joins us every couple of months for Smart Nutrition here on Midday. Monica blogs at nutritionovereasy.com. You can sign up for her newsletter there and get information about the panoply of nutrition-related topics that Monica researches and reports on. We've got a link at wipr.org/midday. That'll do it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, why Baltimore school children were either kept out of school altogether or went to schools that had little or no heat last week. A few schools still aren't open this week, I think. I'll talk to public officials and local activists about how we've gotten to this sorry place and how we can get out. That's tomorrow on Midday, coming in from the cold at the Baltimore Public Schools. Lunch today was provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies, with locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the Square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. For more information, you can find them on the web at dangerouspiesbalt.com. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.